I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with George Dvorsky. George is a dear old friend and a fellow of my Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, our Institute for... Actually, you're not a fellow. You're a board member, but you've become... You started to act like a fellow because you started writing so much.
I'm on the board, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So he's a board member of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and was on the board of the World Transhumanist Organization, one of the founding board members of that. And so welcome, George.
Thank you, Jay.
George, you have always been a very sterling example of the public engaged and quite eclectic intellectual. And recently, your life has opened up again, and you've got the opportunity to start writing about stuff. So we're going to talk about a whole range of different topics that you've addressed in recent articles. But I want to first mention Sentient Developments, which is your podcast and blog. And why don't you tell people how they can find Sentient Developments, because all of your stuff is there.
Sure. I started the Sentient Developments blog back in 2002. So I've been blogging for quite some time now, and it's always been under the name Sentient Developments, although it's been under a number of different, I guess, front ends in terms of how I've been able to actually enter the blog items themselves. Most recently, I've migrated the blog over to Blogspot, which is an excellent service. So all you need to do is just key in sentientdevelopments.blogspot.com. And of course, being the technophile that I am, and many transhumanists are early adopters, I'm also now into the whole podcast thing, which to me is an absolute wonderful way to again use the technologies at hand for basically conveying my thoughts and my concerns, and even putting down interviews and using new media. And it's just wonderful that anyone in their living room can put together a fairly decent production of an audio cast and put it out there on the web for anyone to download in MP3 format. So that's also accessible through the main page of my blog, Sentient Developments. And again, just the focus that I have on my blog they tend to be transhumanistic themes, tech progressive themes as well. But again, just a broad spectrum of topics. Basically, I describe it the transhumanist perspectives on science, technology, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. And obviously, that entails a whole myriad of different topics and subtopics.
Some of the discerning listeners may be able to tell, George is a Canadian. He lives up there in Toronto. And he's also the president of the Toronto Transhumanist Association, and that has gotten going again. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the TTA has actually been around since about August of 2002. It was co-founded by myself and Simon Smith, again, who I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with. He's the editor-in-chief of Better Humans. And we got the group going in 2002, and it got off to a really good start. And we had a good group of people that came in regularly for our meetings. Simon and I, we would meet fairly regularly for administrative purposes, and we put out some press releases when we felt we needed to. For example, when the Bill C-6 was passed here in Canada, which was a very restrictive piece of bio legislation. Similarly, we put out press releases when the Raelians had the publicity stunt for their cloning claim, and we just wanted to make sure that the TTA and the transhumanist movement was as distant as possible from that. Of course, the Raelians hitting a bit close to home for us here in Toronto, because they have a real significant presence in the province of Quebec, for example. And I do know that there are a number of Raelians in Canada itself. At some of our TTA meetings, we would have Raelians show up. And I know that at one time, Simon estimated that as much as about 40% of the Better Humans readership were in fact coming from the Raelians themselves. So we were organizing events and speakers. We had Eliezer Yudkowsky come in. I know that you yourself, James, came in one time for a talk, and we had Ben Best come in to do a talk on cryonics. But like many things, the TTA took a lot of time and a lot of energy. And eventually, Simon and I, we had different priorities and different interests, and basically the TTA was fairly idle for probably about a year to 2 years. And in the last several months, I've decided that it was I missed it tremendously. I missed being out there and being with the community. I've also had another personal desire to be in the community and be activistic. I think that there definitely needs to be a tech progressive voice, not just in Toronto but in Canada. And I'm hoping that I might be able to fill that niche in the next few months and years.
You're also trying to find a cyber goth girlfriend.
And yes, that's actually true. And you know what? You know, having TTA meetings may be exactly the route that will finally introduce me to that that cyber goth girl of my dreams. But I will certainly let you know if and when that should happen. I decided to get the TTA up and running again, and I managed to collect again. Just go about it the normal way that you do. You start to organize events, and this time the events are going to be much more focused. We had already an excellent talk by Alan Randall on cryonics. Next week we're going to have Dr. Mark Walker come in on super longevity. I've been hitting all the various lists and hitting the local newspapers and the events calendars, and basically getting the word out that we're a regular group and bringing people on board. And like I mentioned earlier as well, I want this to have the group to also be a way to exert some kind of a voice anyways, or at least a go-to organization for the press or anyone who wants a soundbite or perspective on the other side of the coin when it comes to the biotech revolution and enhancement technologies. And that's something that I'm personally going to be working at over the next several months to get the word out that we are the group to go to in terms of speaking to these issues. So yeah, it's been fun and it's been fulfilling, and hopefully I can keep the TTA growing. And I'm inspired by the humanists that come out, because the first talk that we had the leaders from no fewer than three humanist groups come out. The Toronto Humanists, we had Kitchener-Waterloo area humanists, and even a university group, the Secular Alliance. And I see the amount of people that come up for their events and the quality of their events, and I'd have to think that given enough time and organizing that I could probably achieve a similar thing for transhumanists in the local area here in Toronto.
Who's that Canadian writer who wrote Handmaid's Tale? I'm spacing out her name.
Margaret Atwood.
Margaret Atwood. Yeah, I always think of how the Canadians view the United States through that book, because here you have this a theocratic dictatorship get established in the United States, and all the free thinkers in the United States are trying to escape across the border into Canada. And I wonder if the humanist movement in Canada is motivated by this this juggernaut of Christian fundamentalism that they see to their south.
No, for sure. I mean, I think Canada is very much, Canadian culture and our political ideas are very much formed and informed by our neighbors to the south. But I think more than anything these days with the globalized culture and internet culture, that there is, I guess, less and less of those types of feelings, I think. And I do know that Torontonians tend to be pretty tech savvy. We recently found out that Toronto is going to be a live city, meaning that it's going to have Wi-Fi internet access in the GTA. And these are the kinds of things that happen with great regularity in Toronto. I mean, we've even got Steve Mann, the so-called cyborg, although definitions perspective, I don't actually think he qualifies as being a cyborg, more of a fiborg, but obviously that he speaks to a lot of people, and most people in Toronto are aware of the work that Steve does, and he has his undergrad students that are very much tuned into the whole the tech future, the cyborg future. So I think that I think the Canadians for the most part are very techno aware, and I think that works to our advantage with the TTA. I know that Justice de Taizier has some luck organizing transhumanists in Quebec, in Montreal in particular. And I'm also hearing rumblings of transhumanists wanting to organize in the West Coast in Vancouver in particular, but I haven't heard anything about that recently. You might know more about that than I would. But, we have many countries, obviously, that have transhumanist groups. But I think within the United States and in Canada, we actually have local groups that are in cities. So I think that speaks well to kind of a further granulation of transhumanist memes in terms of people wanting to organize themselves for more intimate community groups.
I think that the TTA has always been a very encouraging example, because what this movement has been an internet-based movement, and so there's an extremely vigorous conversation on the web where people will exchange 20, 30 messages a day, and their entire intellectual life revolves around that. But they never meet anybody in the flesh, and they never have any physical commitment to sufficient commitment to an actual human being that they know to send $10 for anything, you know?
Yeah.
And how can you build a movement if people aren't willing to commit their time and treasure other than just, you know, have an be on an email list?
And it's so true. And, I mean, again, one who's very keen on communications technologies and internet technologies, there is something lost without there being that in-person interaction with someone. And this was really driven home to me at one of our meetings when we had a middle-aged couple showed up, and they were from the United States. And this was actually soon after 9/11 had happened. And there was a bit of issue at the time with visas and cross-border issues, and they were actually temporarily stuck in Canada. And they came out to a TTA meeting, and the reasons for them coming out to the meeting became quite evident very soon thereafter when the man looked me right in the face, and he said, looked right in my eyes, and he said, "George, I have a cryonics contract with Alcor, and I am worried that should anything happen to me here while I'm in Canada, that there's going to be an issue for me to get my body properly sent to a facility for cryonic preservation." And he says, "What can you do to help me with that?" And I was like, whoa, that really made me realize that a local group is more than just, philosophical wanking, that there's actually a purpose to getting together and helping each other out, looking at what some of the more pressing issues are, what some of the real-world issues are that can be tackled today. And it got me thinking about, what could we do for this individual? And then I've been wondering ever since then, what are issues in terms of getting corpses transferred from Canada to a U.S.-based facility? Are there any issues that we should be aware of? It's just been announced that in 2008, every Canadian citizen is going to require a visa to be able to go into the United States. This is happening at the same time where in Europe, for example, the borders are becoming less and less defined, and you can literally walk from country to country without this kind of strict paperwork. But here we in North America, we seem to be going in the opposite direction. So and the point I'm making is that had we had this kind of interaction over the Internet, it might not have made such an impact on me. But to actually have this couple, in my presence in with such a concern kind of, again, drove the importance of the issue home to me.
Yeah, it's not your average person that you know through an email list who you can ask to cut off your head jacket full of antifreeze and to make sure that it gets shipped in dry ice to another country.
Yeah.
That's a pretty personal level of commitment for somebody.
Yeah. But again, that being said, though, as well with the TTA, and something, again, you can't necessarily do over the internet list, is we do want to have a social aspect to it. And we're going to have movie nights. We're going to have nights where we go to the pub, have a beer and, discuss the post-singularity existence and so on. And so in other words, there's going to be fun. And we don't want it to be a purely stuffy philosophical or intellectual group or even an activist group. We do want to have kind of that element to the group, which is relaxed and fun.
This relates, by the way, this is Jay Hughes. You're on Change Surfer Radio, and we're talking to George Dvorsky, who's a board member of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and the blogger at Sentient Development's blog. And one of the articles that you wrote recently, you've written a couple articles about virtual worlds, which kind of relates to this. We have all been playing around a little bit with Second Life and some of these other virtual worlds. And there's always been an expectation or a hope that as VR developed and more realistic communication and instantiation of avatars developed, that we would be able to develop more realistic relationships and communication inside these worlds. Do you think that that's beginning to happen? Is that what you see happening?
Yeah, actually, I very much do, although I don't necessarily think that we're there quite yet. I've also been experimenting with Second Life and kind of doing a bit of preliminary research for my talk at the Stanford event in May, where I'll be talking about potential issues as they surround to the expansion of personhood. I'm speaking specifically to that. Will we ever see the day where we can legitimately say that our online presence has as much personhood moral worth as we do here in the real world? So what I did, I downloaded Second Life, installed it, and created a character for myself and started walking around the bizarre world that Second Life is. And I actually left the experience a little less than enthusiastic about the whole thing. But that's only in terms of, what the technology is today. That has absolutely no bearing on where I think this will be in a few years from now. I think that by all means, a virtual world and a virtual working environment will vastly be superior to just text-based communications in terms of being able to interact with one another. I know that Giulio Prisco, for example, is going to be organizing an event where he's going to be speaking about transhumanism in Second Life, and I thought that's so extraordinary. And that's, again, a good example of where perhaps this virtual world can transcend the limitations of text-based email. But as you mentioned, Jay, another aspect of this is will a virtual world result in a more legitimate form of personal expression? And the first thing that happens to you when you get into Second Life is you start to obsess over your physical appearance. And you end up spending an inordinate amount of time adjusting your cheekbone level, the color of your pants, and so on. And I know that I spent a ridiculous amount of time just making sure that I wanted to look exactly the way that I looked. But it really, then I kind of took a step back and asked myself, what is it that I'm doing? Why do I feel this is so important? And I realized that, well, this is the whole thing about a virtual world, and even when it comes to modifying technologies here in the real world, is it is a venue for one to at least give them a venue for where they can properly reinvent themselves and express themselves in the way that they see fit. While I never was able to perfectly achieve my avatar, I never nailed my avatar down exactly where I wanted it to, it did get me thinking that, you know what, I can actually express myself in this world physically far better than I really can in the real world. I mean, my genetic makeup is very specific, and I had nothing to do over my genetic constitution. But here in the virtual world, I can look exactly the way I want to do, the way I want to be. And in a way, it is a form of self-actualization that is probably impossible here in the real world. So, again, given more advanced communications, better graphics, better means to communicate with each other in these virtual worlds, I can see it most certainly being perhaps a heightened way for humans to interact with each other that will perhaps at some level never match the sophistication and intimacy of real human-to-human contact in the real world, but at the same time, I think it might just actually represent a new form of person-to-person communication where we may not be so inhibited because of our physical appearance, but we're actually quite confident in the ways that we look and the ways that we can express ourselves in terms of the settings and our appearances in these virtual worlds.
Well, one of the forms of self-expression that's happening in the virtual worlds and in Second Life in particular is gender play. And there are people making and selling designer genitalia. There are sex emporiums in Second Life. There are places where S&M emporiums where you can go and have an S&M experience. And there's mature areas where kids aren't allowed. Recently, there was a controversy because apparently there's some age play going on where people are pretending to be pedophiles and with other adults.
Oh, wow.
And the question is, should that be allowed in Second Life and things like that? But you have written about postgenderism, and this seems to be a nice segue into that topic because you got this Wikipedia entry that you've been vigorously defending and at Wikipedia to defend this idea. What's your idea there?
Well, the idea of postgenderism, I don't think it's highly original. I think it's really a variant on some of the things that the cyborg feminist Donna Haraway had to say back in the early 80s. But I think that perhaps where I've taken it in a different area is that Donna Haraway was speaking specifically to feminist-based issues and was speaking specifically to women and in the ways that women can use enhancement technologies, particularly cybernetic technologies, to truly emancipate themselves. Haraway's issue was, and her form of feminism was such that she felt that as long as women remain as reproductive units, as kind of the integral instrument for the ongoing survival and procreation of the species, they would forever and ever be subjugated. And that only until the shackles of their biology were removed could women finally achieve true liberation. So I don't believe she specifically used the terminology post-gender or post-genderism. I think she obviously chose to use the term cyborg instead, or hinting at a post-biological entity, I do think that that's where the idea originated.
Of course, our IET Board of Advisors member, Martine Rothblatt, wrote the book, The Apartheid of Gender, where she argues for post-genderism as well as a legal concept, that we should get rid of all legal distinctions around gender.
And the in fact, reading Harway, it got me thinking as well as obviously not as a woman reading this, but as a man thinking this and wondering how can something like this apply to me as a man. And at the same time that I was into Harway, I was also very much into perhaps a less known area of philosophical thought, and that is the area of what's called masculism. Now, masculism is not masculinism, which is kind of a group of woman haters that are pure reactionaries to the effects of feminism. Masculism takes a more temperate approach to gender-based issues and takes a step back and asks, just in which ways does gender impact on to the detriment of both men and women? And in which ways do gender roles, in fact, enhance our relationships, both with partners and with family members and so forth? And it tries to take a stripped-down look at individuals and how both gender that is both physically and psychologically ingrained and how those gender attributes that are sociologically ingrained both work to the benefit and disadvantage of people. So it got me thinking, again, the intertwining Haraway's idea with masculist ideas that really what we should be talking about is, in fact, a post-genderist future where we can, in fact, remove those elements of our gender that we do find are to our detriment. And, Jay, one time you said something to me that is forever stuck to me, and that is, for example, you said testosterone kills. And it's disturbingly and a disturbingly apt observation. And especially, you know, here in Toronto where we're having gun issues, and every time I hear about a 16-year-old boy who was gunned down by another 16-year-old boy, I think to myself, testosterone kills. Because we're not hearing about girls shooting each other. We're not hearing about 15 and 17-year-old girls getting into their cars and racing at extreme speeds down the street only to smash into a telephone pole and kill themselves. Obviously, I mean, I'm perhaps focusing on adolescence here, but I do think that testosterone issues and other male issues that are self-destructive, even potentially abusive, stick with men, throughout their entire lives.
Your discourse, your ideas here are also being explored in the gay and transgender community, because there's a lot of people in those communities who are trying to reclaim gender play and gendered roles and the ability to explore the extremes of feminine expression and male expression in positive ways. And the same political questions are raised. Is that a reinforcement of all the negative aspects of patriarchy, or is that in fact empowering when a woman can be a drag king and act like a guy for a while?
Except that in my discussions with those in those movements, particularly those within the transsexual movement, not that really could be described as a movement, as it is a group of people actually self-actualizing themselves based on what they feel is their true physiological self. When I've addressed the issues of post-genderism to them and the idea of actually there being post-biological existence or a non-gendered existence, the reaction has been overwhelmingly negative. And the reason, at least as best as I can tell, is that these are individuals who have been very much focused on the achievement of a specific gender and the achievement of very specific gender roles and ways in which they can express themselves that meets their expectations of how they want to be. And to suddenly tell someone that actually no, let's move away from gender, it seems kind of antithetical to a certain degree, because as I continue to kind of articulate these thoughts in my mind about what post-genderism actually means, there is a part of me that is very much saying that post-genderism is exactly that, that it is the elimination of gender for future individuals. And I'm talking truly about post-biological organisms that are non-gender specific. And again, back to the masculist train of thought, at the same time that psychologically we would want to retain those characteristics from our biological heritage that are positive. In other words, what are those things about being a man that are inherently positive? And what are those things about being a woman that are inherently positive? And let's retain those things. And while at the same time rejecting those things about both gender roles and gender expectations and how gender affects our psychology, those things that are to our detriment, we will discard those we will discard those elements.
I recently sent around that Buddhist bioethics essay that I had commissioned from the Encyclopedia of Bioethics. And at the key, you know, one of the key aspects, as you are also a Buddhist or interested in Buddhism.
That's right.
And one of the key aspects, as you know, of Buddhist ethics is this integration of compassion and wisdom. And of course, the Buddhist iconography and understanding of these issues has always had a gendered dimension to it. Like in Tibetan iconography, you have the bell and the Dorje being a symbol of compassionate action, and the bell being a symbol of emptiness. And so, there's always been this interplay of masculine and feminine in our understanding of these things. Well, when you get over into Western ethics, there's this discourse around Carol Gilligan saying that women reason from a place of compassion, and men reason from a place of principles and you know, moral reasoning. And I think, you know, when you put it in that kind of context, you can see there has to be an integration of these things. You can't have moral reasoning without compassion. You can't have compassion without moral reasoning. You can't have the wisdom without the compassion. So, absolutely. I mean, I think we need to break down these arbitrary dimensions and integrate these things in ways they haven't before.
And I think here in the West as well, there is, I think, a big emphasis on the importance of, I guess, gender pairing off of two people of the opposite gender. And you really see this in the gay marriage debate. And the idea that, and again, a similar kind of idea that was recently expounded by the Pope in his recent statement, the idea that the true family unit, and as a consequence, the community and society itself, is dependent on that heterosexual pairing, that it is through the female role and the male role and their ability to not just interact with each other, but what it then speaks to their ability to raise a child and to be part of a community is paramount, that you can't mess with that. And I know that this has been expressed by some who are opposed to gay marriage, the idea that embarking on, in a world where we have two men raising a family or two women raising a family, that it is a bizarre and dangerous social experiment, and as a place that we shouldn't go, because it's a potential form of child abuse. And it's one that I reject out of hand. To me, that is an explicit form of homophobia. It is completely undermining the ability of responsible gay parents to raise children, and at the same time, it's the fetishization of the heterosexual union. And
it's a biology as destiny argument, because the argument, as you point out, is that a woman can't provide masculine features of that is associated with a father role. You know, and that's absurd. Both men and women can provide both male and female aspects of parenting to a child.
Yes, I put these ideas all kind of together in this post-gender argument for. Really, what I probably should do is do exactly what Donna Haraway did, and that is actually put this down into a coherent statement or a manifesto and get it out there. What I did was kind of tried to cheat a little bit, and I put a quick article together and posted it on Wikipedia, and I think I was probably fairly criticized in doing that, as that's really not the purpose of Wikipedia. The purpose of Wikipedia is to enter already established encyclopedic references, and enter encyclopedic references to already established ideas. So I believe the article is still there, but I don't expect it to be there for too much longer. It's been regarded as a neologism, but I just have to get my act together and I think put this down into a more cogent and coherent statement.
One of the other issues that you've been much more forthright about than most people in the transhumanist movement, and that is even a little bit problematic for me, is your advocacy of animal rights. I've been fairly explicit about the kind of hierarchy of being that I would like to see enacted into law. But I think you are a little bit more radical than me in believing in the moral authority or the moral importance of vegetarianism and stopping factory farming and things like that. You're a little bit more of a Peter Singerite. Do I characterize your position correctly?
Absolutely. I'm very much influenced by the writings of Peter Singer. I don't agree with everything that he has to say in regards to our treatment of non-human animals. For example, he even finds the idea of having pets as being morally incorrect, as in some way being demeaning to the animal. And I don't agree. I think There is a lot that can be gained from the relationship that one would have with a pet. I think both the pet and the human actually get a lot out of that relationship and of that interaction, and no one is necessarily demeaned by that relationship. That being said, Peter Singer has had a massive influence on my thinking in terms of how we need to be treating non-human animals. In conjunction with that, Buddhism has really opened my eyes to what is meant by the compassion for all sentient creatures. And, of course, my work in transhumanism and thinking forward and thinking about the advent of different types of persons, artificial persons, humans that have transcended human biology to such a degree that they can no longer be considered Homo sapiens, and what does that mean in terms of the expansion of personhood rights in that direction. And really what it all boils down to is my belief in non-anthropocentric personhood theory. I think one cannot look to the future and to more advanced forms of personhood without looking into some of the more, at the risk of using this word, more primitive forms of personhood. And I have perhaps taken the idea of personhood and the respect of experiential existence to places that perhaps even some animal rights people are reluctant to. For example, there's discussion about cows and goats who are regarded as some of the most unintelligent creatures on the planet, although that's actually highly debatable topic right there. But let's just assume for a moment that the cow is as dumb as everybody says it is, that it actually does not manage to fulfill many personhood criteria. And I think, for example, of Fletcher's personhood criteria, which is a really good starting point to discuss some of these issues. Let's just assume for a moment that the cow cannot, imagine itself too far into the future, that it cannot make plans, that to a certain degree it cannot really, be self-reflective about itself and its existence. One thing is undeniable about that organism, though, is that it is experiential. It undeniably experiences emotions. It unquestioningly has interactions with its fellow cattle. It experiences its day unlike any other creature. It grazes, it chews its cud, and it does what it's supposed to do in terms of a cow living its life. And I also know from anecdotally speaking that when it comes time for cattle to head toward the slaughter and the killing floor, that there is a general sense of panic in amongst these creatures. What I'd like to basically see in regards to all this is not necessarily, although I would like to, there's discussion about expanding personhood to some of the higher mammals like elephants, the gorillas, and even whales and dolphins, which I think is wonderful and definitely should probably be done. But if we could maybe not create a person category, but certainly create another category for an animal that they're given moral weight, that would be what I've called experiential organisms that are deserving of our moral consideration. So things like cows and chickens and goats. And of course, I'm mentioning farm animals only because they're within our custodial responsibility. We have factory farms and where these animals are produced and abused and for human consumption. And that, I think, is something I would really like to see more work on in the future to protect their rights. And recently, I was encouraged to see in the papers that there's been great advances made in terms of our ability to create synthetic meat. This is basically meat that's grown in a petri dish. And I'm sure many among the meat eaters listening right now are probably wincing a bit, and rightfully so. I can only imagine, the aesthetic value of eating meat out of a petri dish. But I can only imagine that these sorts of things will be, I guess, more refined over time. And again, one of the big issues right now is to be able to produce this kind of synthetic meat in factory format for mass production. But really, the point I'm getting at with all this is that I haven't eaten meat in quite some time, and I consider myself to be a very healthy person. Meat is not a necessary part of our diet. It's a superfluous thing. It's an affluent thing, and it is to the detriment of the non-human animals, as far as I'm concerned. So it's an immoral act. And whereas at one time our survival was perhaps dependent upon hunting and eating of meat, it most certainly is not an integral part of our survival today. And further, with the advent of artificial meat, there are now alternatives, so the idea of having factory farms and raising livestock has become even less justifiable and will continue to become less justifiable over time.
George, we have to bring this to a close, but one last topic where I know that we share a common passion, and that's Battlestar Galactica. You recently wrote an article about the science of Battlestar Galactica, and you know, isn't this just the most rockin' show on TV? It's when I recently flipped across the channel to Star Trek Next Generation, which my wife and I used to passionately watch every single time it was on. And, you know, I was a big fan of that when it was on. But when you compare the gritty reality, the level of West Wing politics that happens in Battlestar Galactica, the tensions between the military and the civilians and black markets and prostitution and all the things that they address there that were just completely off the radar for earlier generations of science fiction. It's a really amazing show, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, in fact, a very encouraging sign. Science fiction on television has it's had its high and low moments over its history. And definitely Star Trek, right, from the original Roddenberry series, and most obviously, particularly with the 1980s and early 90s version, was a very important in terms of science fiction. Books have been written, and I've actually got a number on my shelf. There's the physics of Star Trek. There's the ethics of Star Trek, the metaphysics of Star Trek, and rightfully so. I mean, these episodes, I still, even in my own writings, I will definitely drop allusions to some episodes or some incidences because I think they're definitely relevant to philosophical discussion or a point that you're trying to make. But one thing that was definitely lacking in Star Trek was that kind of gritty realness that you're seeing in Battlestar Galactica. You're right, it is very much a West Wing kind of set in space, and I think that's kind of this post 9/11 world that we now live in, which is very much on edge and high melodrama, and people are, I guess their sensibilities are a little bit more severe than they were in the 80s and the 90s with Star Trek. So it's definitely speaking to people that way. But one thing I think is still missing in television science fiction, and even in Hollywood science fiction as well, is really the conveyance of transhumanist and futurist themes as they are in literature these days. I think literature is still very much where it's at. Egan and others have certainly are describing those things that I think are in terms of the genre of science fiction having a social purpose as a speculative fiction. I think that the written word is where it's at. Where I'd like to see Battlestar Galactica perhaps get to are, in fact, some issues, but I don't think they're going to do this. Or will be issues of, enhancement technologies and procreative freedoms. And although they may actually very well be getting there with the Cylons and uploading, because that's a direct issue that pertains to transhumanists in terms of the ability to transfer one's thoughts to a different substrate.
Yeah, the medicine in Battlestar Galactica is 20th century medicine. They don't have any life extension or any of that stuff.
No.
But they do seem to be dancing around the issue of a transhuman rights framework, because there's been these issues around, is it okay to torture this machine? When do the machines have moral rights? When should they be considered prisoners of war and things like that?
That is true, and I'd like to see them take it to even further extremes and to further make it relevant, at least as far as where the important discussions are at. And I think it's important because, take Star Trek, for example. People, they tend to take the Star Trek universe for granted and take it as gospel, and they imagine that, this is actually a foreshadowing of where humanity will be centuries down the line. We'll be, utterly human, riding in spaceships, traveling around the galaxy. And that's utterly not true. I think in the 24th century, we will most certainly not be humans traveling around in spaceships around the galaxy. And I think that it's important that our fiction kind of relay, even if it is fiction, at least give us some kind of a speculative aspect that's grounded in some kind of reality. And I've always been a fan of the more hard versions of science fiction that tend to be rooted more in scientific fact.
George, it's been a delight talking to you as always, and I look forward to seeing you at the Human Enhancement Technologies
Absolutely.
And Human Rights Conference, May 26 to 28 at Stanford University. And tell us again what you're going to be talking about there.
My topic is tentatively titled Me, Myself, and I, Personhood, Issues and Ethics in the Age of the Distributed Self. So the idea that will you at some point in your life be able to say you are not just one person, but you are a multiplicity of persons, each with their own set of rights to protect them.
Excellent. Looking forward to that. See you very soon.
Cheers, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio.
a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.